This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You know, from a playoff standpoint, this is the best kind of loss. It's a loss to an AFC team, so that doesn't hurt you in things like tiebreakers if we get a chance to discuss those later on in the season. It helps you because things like division record and then conference record are more important than anything else. And look, they went on the road as a 7-point underdog and lost to a Super Bowl contending team, a team that is exceptional offensively with right now, I think, the quarterback that is playing the best of any quarterback in the NFL, although our guy isn't that far off. They were in this game. They were. They just could not get a you-know-what stop on defense. You know, from the end of the first quarter through the rest of the game, three quarters of football, the Ravens didn't get stopped. They just kept possession of the football. Washington's last stop defensively came at the end of the first quarter, and for the rest of the afternoon, Baltimore had their way with them. I mean, it was really easy for the Ravens to move the football up and down the field the rest of the way. I thought and said all last week that this game would be a measuring stick game, even though Dan Quinn, you know, pushed back on that. You know, these coaches, and it's the right way to handle it, talk about these games in the way they should be talked about them if you're playing in them. And that is, every week is like its own deal. It's like separate from anything that came before it or anything that'll come after it. We see that every week in the NFL. Things are just about the matchup and about that particular day. But with respect to, you know, the first five games of the season, a four-game winning streak, offensively what they had been through five games, defensively what they had not been through five games, I thought from our standpoint, from a fan standpoint, that we would be able to measure a little bit about the team up against Baltimore in that environment. And look, bottom line is, even though they lost the game, offensively, they measured up very well. They played about as well as you could play in that environment offensively, and the offense gave the team a chance to win for a fifth straight game. You know, the offense had been the catalyst for the four-game winning streak, and they played well enough yesterday to win in Baltimore. Offensively, from a measuring stick game standpoint, they measured up. Defensively, not so much, you know. And let's put the, you know, the important information up front, which is they were facing a team that's going to make a lot of defenses, even good defenses, look bad. Baltimore is excellent. And Lamar Jackson, my God, is he playing at a high level. Last week, and I talked about it, that against Cincinnati, Cincinnati loaded up the box similar to what Washington did yesterday, and they said, we're going to stop the run. We want to see Lamar beat us with his arm, and he did. And Lamar can now beat you with his arm. Not that he couldn't do it before, but as a straight drop-back passer, now a lot of play-action drop-back for Baltimore yesterday, but this guy is just right now feeling it. How old's Lamar right now? 28 years old? Denton, is he 27, 28?
He's 27, I think.
Okay, so, you know, this idea that the book's been written on Lamar Jackson, and look, he's going to have to clear that playoff hurdle. He's going to have to clear it. He's going to have to prove that he can get it done in the postseason, that he can strap a team to his back when they're down by a score or down by two scores and lead them to victory. That's kind of the last hurdle he needs to clear. He's a two-time MVP. This guy is great. And he is entering, for that position, his prime years of his career. Literally entering those years. So, look, defensively, it was not a good day for Washington. The competition, however, was legit top tier. You know, I mentioned last week, I was still very concerned about what this team was defensively. I just wasn't buying what I saw last week against the worst offensive team in the NFL. Washington just went from the worst offensive team in the NFL to probably the best offensive team in the NFL in back-to-back weeks. I wasn't buying really what I saw in Arizona. I thought Arizona, the idea that they could, you know, move the football against anybody without their quarterback, without their 5'6" quarterback being involved in the run game, was insane to me. But for some reason, they decided not to run them against Washington. So I was concerned with what the defense was, and it was a measuring stick game from that standpoint. Could they step up? Could they compete a little bit, you know, a little bit? Could they hang in there? Could they, you know, stop a couple of possessions with the game hanging in the balance? It was a rough day defensively. Really, really rough. And I think, again, understanding the competition and understanding that you're not going to have to face that again. You're not going to have to face Lamar Jackson and Derrick Henry and Zay Flowers and Mark Andrews and everything they've got offensively. Remember, the Ravens coming into the season were a bit of a question mark offensively because of the changes to the offensive line. They're just fine. Year two of Todd Monken is going pretty damn well for the Ravens. It was not a good day, and the defense didn't measure up. And because of it, Washington's legitimate chance of kind of winning a game wasn't as legitimate as we had hoped. But to me, look, let's focus on the good news, the where they did measure up. They measured up at the quarterback position. Jaden Daniels, once again, proved, convinced anybody who was watching that game, and anybody that knows anything about football, fan-wise or otherwise, he proved yesterday that he is legit real. He, you know, proved it in a way yesterday that was different than the way he had proved it in the last four games, or the first five overall. Because yesterday, they did it in a different way in terms of moving the football and scoring points. Now, what he is week in and week out is he is poised, he is calm, he is cool, he is in control. He seems to be, you know, understanding everything that's going on and does not really show any signs. I'm talking about the mental part of the game of being a rookie. But yesterday, he threw the ball at an extremely high level against a team that had made his offense one-dimensional, completely one-dimensional. Washington was the number three rush offense coming into the game. Yesterday, they could not run the football. Now, you might say they chose not to. That's fair. But Baltimore's defense coming in was excellent against the run. They were very weak. They were porous against the pass. I had no problem with the way Kingsbury decided to attack Baltimore. It did make them one-dimensional. And the Ravens, look, they played contain rush. So it really came down to, could this rookie quarterback, Jaden Daniels, which all the analytics people told you before the draft, yeah, doesn't process quickly, pressure to sack percentage, can't throw the ball over the field, over the middle of the field, etc. Straight drop back, pretty much the entirety of the game he had to deliver, and he did. You know, Baltimore didn't let him out of the pocket that much. You know, a couple times he got free, scrambled for a first down. But for the most part, he had to deliver on schedule, in the pocket, slinging the football to receivers. And he did it. Offensively, Washington had 9 drives in the game. This has been a theme to their season so far. Not a lot of drives per game, but high production level in each possession they have. They scored on 5 of the 9 drives, had a chance on a 6th, but the field goal at the end of the first half got blocked. And Daniels, in a one-dimensional offense on the road, hostile environment, in a game in which really the score context meant they had to have it on a lot of those drives, especially in the second half. 24 of 35 for 269, two touchdowns, no interceptions. He took three sacks in the game, 38 dropbacks in that situation. That ain't bad. One of them was, you know, a scramble back to the line of scrimmage or just short of it. And there was one very important drop, which I will get to in the game take. This was absolutely, in my opinion, the way to attack Baltimore again. But Jaden still had to do it. You know, Josh Allen didn't do it, you know, on Sunday Night Football a couple of weeks back when they got absolutely run out of the building by the Ravens 35-10. Dak Prescott, I mean, against the Ravens in week three when they were both, you know, sitting there in need of a win. Dak Prescott, let's face it, he did nothing for three quarters. And then when Baltimore took their foot off the pedal in the fourth quarter, he got a little bit hot. Jaden Daniels is in complete control. Look, there's some real benefit that Cliff Kingsbury as his offensive coordinator is providing. There's no doubt about it. But this guy sees it. He has studied for it. He processes quickly once the ball is snapped. And once the ball is snapped, he almost always delivers it to the right spot on time accurately. There is a play at the end of the first half that I'm going to get into during my game take, which was high-level, next-level quarterback IQ stuff. I'll get to that in the next segment. He did something on the final drive of the first half that you just don't expect a guy with his experience coming in, five NFL games, to really understand. A lot of veteran quarterbacks don't understand it. He did his part yesterday. They had zero chance without him. In fact, let's be honest, they have zero chance without him every week. He is right now, what's the saying, the stir that draws the proverbial drink. He kept them in the game. Look, the other players on offense, Terry McLaurin may have had one of his better games as a Washington football team player. God, he was good yesterday. And there were others offensively that were good. And the coordinator was good. But, you know, on a day in which the matchup featured a two-time MVP and a quarterback that's gotten more attention than any other that isn't, you know, that's in terms of rookie quarterbacks, if not all of the veteran quarterbacks as well, coming into the game, that matchup showed a guy that's headed towards a third MVP and a guy that's not that far behind him in his rookie season. He's just not playing Jaden on a team as good as Baltimore right now. Six games into his rookie year, I am pretty much sold. Now, you know, I think most of you know that I was sold before the season began, but he has exceeded all expectations. I was hopeful. Many of you were hopeful. Denton was hopeful based on what we had seen in college, that he had a lot of stuff that was translatable to the way the game is played today, and that he could be ready to perform at, you know, a high level earlier than later, but not at this level. Too bad yesterday they couldn't just get something from the defense. You know, something after that interception early. Something after that one punt that they forced early. Because they would have had a chance, a legit chance, to win the game. Look, I don't want to hear about the officiating. I mean, God. I mean, seriously, they gave up 484 yards on nine drives. They gave up 7.5 yards per play. Please. Okay, there were a couple of calls that didn't go Washington's way. I'll get to some of those. But they didn't lose this game because of officiating. That's silly. Again, you know, the battle all year long for this team has been kind of set, right? I mean, there's a clearer picture that's, you know, developed here through six games. And yesterday it was really kind of brought into focus a little bit. The NFL changes. We understand that. There's a lot of change week to week, and matchups mean everything, etc. But this is a team through six games, more than a third of the season, that will be led by its high-level quarterback, who gives them week in and week out a chance to win games. However, they're going to have to be really good. There is not much room at all for, you know, error margin, because they are very limited by a defense that just doesn't have enough right now. You know, look, we expected this roster in 2024 to be deficient in some areas. You know, we weren't sure exactly where they would be. Would it be the offensive line? We were pretty sure it would be in the secondary, certainly a corner. That has definitely come to fruition. They struggle at corner. And let me just mention this one thing. Forbes was inactive yesterday, and I get it. There's an issue, clearly, and Davis was inactive. And, yeah, I know. They were picked by Ron Rivera in the first round. Thank you, Riverboat Ron. But Forbes is the one corner that can run. Like, as I was watching the game yesterday, and I'm watching Zay Flowers just absolutely torch anybody that was covering him in the first half, yesterday actually was a game in which I thought maybe it was because, yeah, he's not going to tackle. I don't know what it is, but he's the one corner that can run. Denton, look up his time, his combine time. Did he run sub 4.4? He's got to be the only sub 4.4 guy they have on defense, right? I think he is.
Yeah, he ran a 4.35.
4.35. Like, when you've got a guy like Zay Flowers out there, and you know you're going to be loading the box and you're going to be in man coverage more than you've typically been in it, you got to have guys that can run on the field. So I guess, look, they're down on him, clearly, right now. But the one thing he does is run. He can actually, hey, chase him around. They're led by a high-level quarterback right now, super high-level quarterback, and an offense each week that's going to give us a chance, and it's going to make these final 11 regular season games a lot of fun to watch. Not just fun, but, you know, it's going to give us, you know, hope that they can win more games than they lose, and they can win maybe a division that's falling apart around them. But they've got a defense that can't bang it out with the better offensive teams. That's clear. You know, they're a year or two, you know, maybe hopefully a year away from adding the kind of talent that they can, you know, compete with the better offensive teams defensively. They'll do fine against the Arizonas and Clevelands and maybe Carolinas and Giants, you know, with the Giants being limited offensively. But the teams that, you know, they're going to have to likely play if they're going to, you know, do something if they get there, you know, I'm they're becoming a favorite to get there. Long way, you know, 11 games left. They're going to play them anyway, understood. But, you know, they can't hold up defensively against teams like Detroit and San Francisco. No chance, or Green Bay. You know, in the NFC, just thinking, you know, about down the road. Long way to go, okay? I don't want to put cart before horse. And look, they can still get better. They've got young players who are still trying to figure it out, guys like Newton and Sanra still, for starters. But for now, this is a team, and the picture's become very clear. The hopes for a playoff type of season rest on the broad shoulders of their rookie quarterback, and he is clearly up to handling that weight. 4-2, as I mentioned, with, you know, one of the losses to an AFC Super Bowl contender. They've got the Panthers coming into town at 1-5. They got blown out at home by the Falcons, who are rolling. But Washington, Denton, is an 8.5-point favorite Sunday. This is, you know, I was talking to somebody yesterday about this when I first saw this line come out. I did a quick back of the, you know, quick research on, because I felt like this may be the largest favorite they've been in a long time. I could have missed something, but I think it's the largest they've been favored by since 2017 It's been 7 years since they've been this big of a favorite. You know, even with some of the teams, let's say in 2018 or in 2021 when they were rolling and won four games in a row, or 2022 when they were 7-5, it's really hard to be a big favorite in the NFL without a quarterback. And they haven't had one, and now they do. Yeah, they were a 12-point favorite in October of 2017 against Kyle Shanahan's 49ers in his first year of coaching the Niners. They only won that game by 2 points, but that was the last time that they were, you know, where they are now at 8.5, you know, more than 7 or 7.5 point favorites. Carolina, I'm just going to give you fair warning. Hubbard can run the football. Dalton's a veteran quarterback that can make plays. And they're probably looking at Washington defensively saying, we can definitely move the football and score in this game. Of course, their issue will be, like with every team that faces Washington, how do we deal with number 5? From Gary on X on Twitter. Kevin, do you really think it's wise to be sold on Jaden Daniels after 6 games? 6 games, question mark, question mark. Really? Question mark, question mark, question mark. We are really desperate around here. I hope everyone is right, but in my 50 years of watching the NFL, I've never seen a fan base fall head over feet faster than this one has for Daniels. Just remember Vince Young, Carson Wentz, Mac Jones. That was an odd one. And, of course, RG3. Thank you, Gary, for that. Appreciate it. You can follow me on Twitter. You can tweet me. You can, you know, respond to anything I tweet, at Kevin Sheehan, D.C. You know what? It is definitely the fastest I can remember as a longtime football fan of a quarterback being anointed as quickly as Jaden Daniels has. I honestly can't think of, other than RG3, I can't think of, in all of my years of watching football, a fan base. And by the way, I would suggest, Gary, it's not just the fan base. It is everybody that talks about, writes about, blogs about, podcasts about the NFL. There is uniform, across-the-board agreement on this one. Washington got it right. And it didn't take 6 games. It took 3. Because the Cincinnati game, the Monday night game, was when it became apparently clear to everybody that Washington had nailed it. By the way, it doesn't mean that everybody's wrong. And it doesn't mean that there aren't good reasons for feeling this way. But I think you're right. I think that the RG3 thing is comparable. I'm not saying the players are comparable, because I don't think they're comparable at all. Did you see, by the way, RG3 put out this tweet last week comparing his stats for the first 4 games of his career, or first 5 or whatever it was, to Jaden's? Did you see that, Denton? Did we talk about that on the air? I forget.
We did not talk about it, but boy, did I see it. It's always about RG3.
Oh my God, I've never seen somebody make it about himself more than he does. Even when he's not, you know, actually, you know, that threatening with making it about himself. And I say threatening meaning, like, so obvious. It's always underlying about himself. But I don't think they're comparable at all in playing style at all. Jaden's a much more advanced NFL, you know, caliber passer than RG3 was as a rookie, actually, as, you know, more so than RG3 ever was as a professional quarterback. That would be, I'm sure I'm missing somebody. Vince Young, I don't think started every game during his rookie year. Did he? I did go back. When he mentioned Mac Jones, I went back to look up Mac Jones's rookie year. And, oh, yeah, no. Vince Young did. Vince Young started a bunch of games his rookie year, and he was Offensive Rookie of the Year. Fair enough. And there was a lot of excitement about Vince Young. I do remember that. I didn't remember that it was, you know, definitely his first year. And of course, Carson Wentz, while not playing on a winning team necessarily, I think they went 7-9 his rookie year. You know, year two was when he was headed towards the MVP prior to getting hurt in the Coliseum against the Rams. Mac Jones, interestingly, Mac Jones was a Pro Bowler his rookie year. He was runner-up in Rookie of the Year in 2021 I looked this up, Ja'Marr Chase. Ja'Marr Chase was Rookie of the Year in 2021. But Mac Jones started all 17 games. The Patriots, in their first year without Brady and a rookie at quarterback, went 10-7. He threw 22 touchdown passes, 13 picks, threw for 3,800 yards as a rookie, had a 68% completion percentage, and he took a lot of sacks, as he always has, but there was... When that one popped up in Gary's tweet, I'm like, Mac Jones, where did that come from? But you know what, Denton? He's actually right. There was a lot of New England is the one that got it right on quarterback in 2021. You know, Trevor Lawrence, I think everybody thought so, but Zach Wilson, Trey Lance, Justin Fields, Bill got this one right. The Patriots got this one right. But different kind of player, of course. It's early. It's really early. I get it. Six games. Absurd. It's the world we're living in right now as sports fans. Like, you're just required, I guess, to have a super strong, conclusive reaction after just a few games. There is no patience. And look at Caleb Williams. After his first game, he throws for 93 yards. They're like, oh. And Jaden's running around in Tampa, and they're like, oh, we got it right. After one game. Look, I think they got it right. I'm sold. I was pre-sold. And now I am for six games in the NFL, and I'm sold. But I get it, Gary. You're not wrong for saying it's way too early. Like, this just doesn't... I mean, Carson Wentz, Vince Young, Mac Jones, RG3, there are probably other examples. But I will say this, the part that he's definitely right about, and I can't, like, off the top of my head, the only comp I can think of is actually RG3 because of his first game in New Orleans and then, you know, a couple of games later in Tampa and then a couple of games after that against the Vikings at home when he had that 76-yard touchdown run. Can you think of any quarterback that's been anointed as the next coming faster than Jaden Daniels, Denton? Does anybody come to mind?
I'm looking up. I mean, C.J. Stroud is the one that comes to mind in Houston.
After six games?
Well, he threw his first interception in his sixth game. He had been perfect when it comes to turnovers in the first five. And they weren't winning. I think, I mean, they were 2-3 after their first five, but it was pretty clear that he was good. But I'm looking at some of those other guys that he mentioned. And, like, you know, Mac Jones is a unique example, but I think you also... Now we rob ourselves of a little bit of the context of Mac Jones because, like, he had a game in his first six where he threw three picks. And the thing about Jaden is that when the lights are bright, he's given you moments and he's performed really well.
He hasn't had one moment, not one. Even the interception in the red zone against Cleveland, that was just immediately erased by, you know, well, remember two plays earlier, he had thrown the 66-yard off-schedule play to Terry. He hasn't had one moment where it's like, that wasn't good, right?
Right. And, like, the only other guy that I was thinking of and was Dak, because remember, they started winning. Like, they lost that first game.
Dak was a fourth rounder. I get what you're saying. But he wasn't anointed because no one was looking to anoint a fourth rounder.
Right. That was more of a conversation of, is he going to keep the job once Tony Romo gets healthy? The answer ended up being yes. But that was the conversation surrounding Dak, and then he's never relinquished that job. I would say that, yeah, Jaden is probably the most anointed. I mean, maybe Andrew Luck, because they were really bad, and they went 10-6. So maybe Andrew Luck, but he's the only other one that I can throw in that conversation.
And they were good his rookie year. You know, they went to the playoffs. He was a Pro Bowler. I think Luck might be one. I want to look up his rookie year first few games. He lost two of the first three games. He threw three interceptions in his first game at Chicago, and they got run out of the building 41-21. So I bet you, you know, look, RG3, at the beginning of 2012, RG3 had much more, had many more believers than Luck did early in that season. They both were playoff quarterbacks in their first year. And they and remember, Luck didn't win Rookie of the Year. RG3 did. He finished second to RG3.
Yeah.
So I the one that I always come back to, and I, you know, I've always felt like he's Mount Rushmore-esque all time. A lot of people don't want to put him there because he didn't win a Super Bowl and he only went to one. Dan Marino did not start every game as a rookie, but when he did finally start as a rookie, it was obvious how good he was. Now, were people in 1983 anointing him as the next coming? I don't think I remember that. I just remember that it was, you know, the next year was one, at that point, that was the greatest quarterback season in the history of the game. In his second season, he threw for 5,000 yards, set the record for touchdowns, set the record for yards in a season. This is 1984, mind you. Okay, no one was throwing really for 4,000 yards in 1984. A few were, Dan Fouts, you know, a couple of others. Marino threw for 5,000 and 48 touchdowns. And so I do remember, obviously, in 84, people are like, well, this guy, you know, he's it. He's 100% it. And, you know, Marino slid in the 83 draft. There were rumors about drug use at Pitt, and he was the last of those quarterbacks. You know, it was Elway, it was Kelly, it was Eason, it was O'Brien. There were six. That was the last time six were taken. I'm forgetting the sixth. Now I got to look it up because it's going to drive me nuts. But Marino was the last one. He was the in 83. There were 28 teams because Washington had the 28th selection and selected Darryl Green, and Marino went the pick before Darryl Green.
Todd Blackledge is the number. Is the guys you were missing?
Yeah, Blackledge, and he was the second one taken. Marino, honestly, it was so obvious the minute he took the field that this was special. What you were watching was special. You know, his rookie year, I'm looking at it right now. He started 9 games. He played in 11. He was a Pro Bowler because of the 9 games. He threw 20 touchdown passes and for 2,200 plus yards in 9 starts. He was an all-pro second team with 9 starts. He finished 3rd in the MVP with 9 starts. That's nuts. I mean, I'm looking this up, and I don't remember that part. That, by the way, was 83. Theismann won the MVP. You know, that's our last MVP. We went back-to-back. 82 was Mark Mosley, the only kicker to win MVP, and in 83, Joe Theismann was the MVP. And I'll pull up the MVP voting. Marino was third. The 1983 MVP voting. Theismann was one, and he was a runaway winner. Eric Dickerson was two. Dan Marino was three. Riggins was four in the MVP voting. How do you finish third in an MVP vote when you only start 9 games? That's how great he was. That's how incredible Marino was when, you know, he got onto the field. I'm going to assume that it was David Woodley that he replaced. I don't think it was Don Strock. I don't think Strock was ever a legitimate starter. He was always a backup. I think it was Woodley because Woodley was the starting quarterback in 82 in the Super Bowl against Washington in Super Bowl 17. But Marino, the buzz about Marino was, wow, that he was the last one taken in the first round, and he's the one that looks like the next coming. Other than that, I think I got to go to 2012 and RG3. and then here. This is probably much greater than Marino because he didn't start those first few games of the season. This is comparable with the reaction to RG3. I can't come up with any other one. I actually want to take calls on this and make it a two-parter, all right? 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980. The two parts are, number one, do you think it's too early, six games, to anoint Jaden Daniels as the next coming, as the next great one? Everybody's done it here over the last couple of weeks. And then number two is, can you remember anything like this? I would say RG3 because it's, you know, within our memory bank. It's right there from 12 years ago. I think everybody after the New Orleans game, after the Tampa game, after the Minnesota game. The Minnesota game, I think, was week six. I think it was. It was week six or week seven in his rookie year. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It was week six. 38-26 over Minnesota. He was 17 of 22 for 182 yards, a touchdown and interception, but he rushed 13 times for 138 yards and two touchdowns, including, I think it was 76 yards. It was 76 yards in the fourth quarter when they were up by five and needed to keep the ball, and he went for 76 yards. And Larry Michaels said, electrifying. He had some absolute wow games. The New Orleans game. Even the St. Louis game week two that they lost. The Tampa game, he drove them down the field. They won the game on a field goal. The Minnesota game. The next game, by the way, was the game in the Meadowlands against the Giants. And he had that unbelievable touchdown pass, if you guys remember, to Santana Moss to take the lead late in the fourth quarter. And then Victor Cruz... Manning to Victor Cruz, 77 yards with a minute 13 left. It was basically the next play because he threw a 30-yard touchdown pass to Santana Moss with a minute 32 to go in the game to give Washington a 23-20 lead. Those first seven games were truly special. You know, and then they went into a bit of a tailspin, but then he had the moment on Thanksgiving Day against the Cowboys, which was incredible. He had the moment against... you know, the Giants. And then, you know, Haloti Ngata, Baltimore game, and the rest is history. Two-parter. One, is it too early to anoint Jaden Daniels as the next coming? And two, is there a comp to how quickly a quarterback has been, you know, essentially anointed as the next coming, like Jaden? Is there a comp for what we are witnessing 6 weeks into the season? And I want to emphasize to Gary and others that have sort of suggested that, you know, the Washington fan base is so desperate, which we are. There's no question about that. But as if to say it's just in Washington that they're feeling this way. They're, you know, they're serial exaggerators to begin with when it comes to their football team. And they're just doing their thing again with this guy. No, this is league-wide. This is the entirety of the league that feels this way. Everybody thinks they got it right. I mean, I was watching, I think Chase Daniel, we got to get him on the show, Denton. I know I've tried and failed, and I know you've tried. Chase does a really good job. I can try to, I've got a way to get to him even more effectively. But he has fallen head over feet or head over heels for Jaden. He's 100% sold. Done. Lock it up. He's the next, you know, Lamar, Mahomes, Josh Allen, combination of all three. So yesterday, real quickly, it was determined that John Allen did have a serious injury, a torn pec, and it looks like he is done for the year, although I guess there's going to be a second opinion. You know, that's, you know, an interesting situation because it raises the idea or the question as to whether or not John Allen has played his final snap for Washington. You know, they drafted Johnny Newton. They drafted drafted best player available, and they did so because that's what you do when you need players, when you need A players. Johnny Newton was the highest rated player on their board. It seemed to surprise everybody in the moment because the idea was that Payne and Allen were a strength of the football team. They haven't played that way. They certainly have not played that way this year, and maybe they saw that too. And maybe they saw also, the coming contract decisions they would have had to make with respect to John Allen. John's a first rate young person, not as young as he once was before, a real mature player, one of the few during the last regime. So I wish him the best. I think John's been a really good player. He's never been an elite player, but he's been a really good player. But yeah, it's possible that we've seen the last of John Allen. And, you know, the thing that hurts a bit is if there were any possibilities of a trade at the deadline of John Allen, that obviously is shot now. But with their record, I doubt that they were going to probably move him at the trade deadline regardless. So good luck to him in getting healthy again. So where are they in the NFC right now? They're the favorite to win the NFC East, but where are they in the NFC right now? I gave you the odds. There are several teams that have better NFC championship odds than Washington, but let's put the odds to the side for a moment because I do believe that they are justified right now to be the favorite to win the NFC East, and I think they're going to win the NFC East. I do. I think that Dallas is done. I think the Giants have built too much of a hole. You know, the Giants, again, not to beat this to death, but, you know, they lost to Washington by 3 because they didn't have a kicker. They had a shot to beat Dallas, and they certainly had a shot to beat Cincinnati on Sunday night. They didn't have multiple players, key players on offense. But I think they've built too much of a hole to climb out of. Washington currently in first place with a half game lead on Philly. And look, the games against Philadelphia are going to be big games. The first one's a Thursday nighter at the Link on November 14th. We're 1 month away, basically, from, you know, a massive NFC East game. It'll be their third NFC East game because they play the Giants on November 3rd. They'll be done with the Giants before they play their first game against Philly or Dallas. But I do think Washington is going to win the NFC East. I think they're good enough. I think they've got the best quarterback in the division. I think they are probably the best coach team in the division. They have the best offense in the division. They are flawed like other teams in the division. Their flaw right now is they are vulnerable defensively, but are either of the teams, three teams in the NFC East, dynamic offensive teams? No, they're not. So Washington's going to win the NFC East, barring a slew of injuries that derail a season, which does happen in the NFL. I believe that right now. I don't think that's going out on a limb. Denton, do you think Washington wins the NFC East today here on October 15th?
Yeah, I do. I mean, watching the other two teams, three teams really, but the other two teams in specifically that everybody has high expectations for, because most people are not sharing the same opinion that you do about the Giants. The Eagles are a disaster. They hate their head coach. Their head coach seems to make it very easy for everybody to hate him. And on the other side, the Cowboys are also a disaster. Their best player seemed to hate playing there, even though he just got paid. And then Jerry Jones was being a maniac on a radio show this morning saying he's going to fire everybody because they asked him hard questions. So, like, those two organizations are completely imploding right now. And then the other one is the Giants, so you don't trust their quarterback. I don't trust their quarterback. They don't trust their quarterback. Washington is the only team in this division that has any sort of real positive momentum. Anything other than an NFC East title right now feels like a disappointment.
Yeah, let me be clear on one thing. I don't believe in the Giants like as a contender in the division. I just know that their defense is good, and Dexter Lawrence right now is tracking towards a Defensive Player of the Year award. I think the biggest threat to Washington, the favorite in the NFC East, feels good to say that, doesn't mean anything, is Philadelphia. And it's because really Philly has the most talent of the other three teams in the division. They've got the most experience, but they've got to get it together because they've got a buffoon as a head coach. They've got him, you know, chirping at fans in the stands after barely hanging on to beat the Browns. I mean, this guy is a true, you know, he is truly lacking overall in self-awareness. And he's not a very good coach, it would seem, either. You know, they brought in basically a new defensive coordinator and a new offensive coordinator and told him, you know, just try not to embarrass us when you're standing on the sideline. I don't think there's a guy that I look at as a head coach in this league that just begs for a punch in the face more than Nick Sirianni. God, he's insufferable. But they have players. They've got players. They've got experience. They've got players that are game-changing players. You know, A.J. Brown is a true game-changing player on offense. Saquon Barkley is a game-changing player. Jalen Carter has turned into a game-changing player. They've got the players. So I do think that because of this dysfunction and the belief that it may not correct itself to the point where they can go on a big heater and win 10 or 11 games, I like Washington to win the division. Washington's quarterback is the best. Their coaching staff is the best in the division right now. Then you look at the rest of the NFC. I don't know what to make of Minnesota, other than it is very clear they are exceptionally well-coached on defense, and they got some players on defense. They are just a dominant team right now defensively in the league. You know, the DVOA numbers that I reference all the time, they're the number one defense in the NFL through the first 6 weeks of the season. Now, they've played five games because they just had their bye week. And it's, like, not even close. Nobody's close to them. Their DVOA number is 21% ahead of number two. That is a massive statistical difference in the DVOA measurement. They're right now the best defense in the NFL per the DVOA measurement, and it's not even close. Offensively, you know, not anywhere near that. Right now, Minnesota offensively is 18th in the league. So I don't know what to make of them, but I certainly think that they've got a chance to win enough games to be a higher seeded team than Washington, which means you'd have to probably go there if they win the division to beat them. But man, that division, I mean, I think Detroit's the best team in the division, and they play Minnesota for the first time this week. 1 o'clock on Fox. That is the game to watch this week. Detroit at Minnesota. Huge NFC North showdown. And then they play them in Detroit on the final Sunday of the season. Detroit still has two games with the Packers. They play the Packers early November on the road. They play them at home in early December. That NFC North is going to be wild all season long. I think whoever comes through the North and wins the division is the second favorite, or maybe the favorite, along with San Francisco. So I guess the way I would frame it, Denton, is the 49ers and the NFC North winner will be two teams when we get to the end of the year, if Washington is the NFC East winner, that I think we'll end up thinking are better than Washington and will have better records than Washington, meaning you'd have to go on the road to play those teams. It's also possible that the NFC North's runner-up as a wild card team, and maybe the third place team from that division as a wild card, could be teams that we would think would be very difficult to beat, even at home. Atlanta's not a good defensive team, but they have become a lethal offensive team because they can do both things. They can beat you through the air, and then they can run it down your throat if you decide you're not going to get beat through the air. They're just not very good defensively. Tampa's probably a better all-around team than Atlanta right now. I just don't think they have the explosiveness or the versatility on offense that Atlanta has. So I would go right now, Washington wins the division, but ends up being behind in terms of who I would like to emerge from the NFC, behind the 49ers, who I'm still expecting to be there, the NFC North winner, and probably the NFC North runner-up. Three teams. Who do you have right now that you think they would be behind in the NFC after winning the division with, say, a 10-7 or an 11-6 record?
I would just say right now, Detroit and San Francisco. I don't know who will be the NFC North runner-up. Maybe if it's Green Bay, because, I mean, Jordan Love played out of his mind this weekend, and he seems to be very much worth the money that they gave him early this offseason. So maybe the Packers. I don't know that if we get to December and January, if we'll still feel as highly about the Vikings. To the point where we would think that they are better than Washington. I still think the Vikings are a playoff team, but I don't know that we'd be looking at them. Let's just say hypothetically, if the Vikings are like 11 and I guess 6 now, and the Commanders are 11-6, if they have the same record, I don't know that we would look at Minnesota as being better than Washington. So I would say the Packers with an asterisk, and then the Lions and the Niners. I'm not there with Atlanta. I think I'm liking Tampa less and less as the season goes on. I don't know. But I think I watched them. I'm just like, I think if Washington played them again, I think Washington would beat them. I think that was just first game of the season, first game of Jaden's NFL career. As he has progressed, I think Washington beats Tampa again if they see them in the postseason.
One of the oddest results of the year is Tampa losing at home to Denver. 26-7, because that followed one of the more impressive wins so far this year, which was Tampa going to Detroit and beating the Lions. It's the only Lion loss, and it was at home. We're going to learn more about Tampa on Monday night. That's a hell of a Monday night game, that first game. It's a doubleheader Monday night, but Ravens at Bucks in the first game Monday night. That's a really good Monday night game. What's the late one? Chargers and who?
Chargers.
Raiders.
Cardinals. I hate the Monday night stack. I just want to watch one Monday night game. I hate the fact that they put two and two on there, unless it is a legit doubleheader. But these, I don't look at these as doubleheaders. These are just stacked games.
Right.
I hate it.
I don't hate it that much. I kind of like it. But I would prefer the doubleheader. Although there was a time when you and I were getting up at 4 a.m. every morning where we would have probably missed at least the second half of the second game, but now that's not an issue. 8:15 Ravens-Bucks, and then 9 o'clock kick Chargers-Cardinals. You know, they're fooling around with those start times on that doubleheader Monday night, trying to find the answer that best, you know, generates ratings.
Can I share a crazy stat with you real quick?
Yeah.
So because we were having this conversation, I pulled up the standings. The Saints are plus 20 in point differential, despite the fact that they've lost four in a row.
Yeah, look at their first 2 weeks.
I mean, that is the craziest stat, I think, right now amongst NFL teams, because they just destroyed
They basically scored like in the mid-40s in their first 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah, they had 47 both. To 10, 44
did they beat
to 19.
In the opener?
Carolina. I was on Carolina that day. Bad day.
Right.
Bad day.
And then they crushed the Cowboys. Fun times ahead. I mean, just 6 weeks into the season, we got 11 Sundays left. Actually, 12, because you get 12 full Sundays left in the season. 18 weeks to play 17 games. And you got a team that's relevant. That is so much better than the alternative, which we've been dealing with for so long.
Well, speaking of the Jets, and this is kind of combining a story, we heard this morning John Allen was on with the Junkies. He said he is going to have season-ending surgery on his pec today.
Okay.
But then along with that, we get news from the Jets that Hassan Reddick is now able to seek a trade. They've given him permission. He had let go of his previous agent. He hired Drew Rosenhaus. Drew Rosenhaus, big name in the agency game. So it looks like Hassan Reddick could potentially be on the move in a matter of days, weeks, who knows.
Do you want him?
Not really. I mean, if you're in the position where you're going to trade for a guy, like, he better have a really good explanation as to why he did not play for the Jets. If it's just about the money,
well,
I can understand that.
About the money.
I can understand that from a personal standpoint, but you also cost yourself $9 million. And you were doing this whole thing in Japan.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where, you know, as an NFL fan and not an NFL, you know, executive or part of a front office, you can say the player's really good. He would clearly add value as a pass rusher to a defense that doesn't have, you know, a legitimate pass rusher right now. And it's a team, by the way, on the rise. It's a team that has a chance this year to win double-digit regular season games and host playoff games, plural. A chance. But you don't know anything about him. And when you have this long of a holdout and he's lost this much money and it's over a contract and the team that he was joining that he got traded to was a team that had Super Bowl aspirations or certainly, you know, deep into the playoffs, you know, contending aspirations. There's things about this person you don't know, you have to know. Because right now what Washington is building, I'm all in for 24, first and foremost, but not at the expense of, you know, putting at jeopardy the future with kind of the foundation and the culture that they're creating. And I just don't know enough about Hassan Reddick to say that he'd be a good fit or a bad fit.
He's been a good player in the league.
He's a good player.
There's no doubt about that. But
you
I do
get better
always
pass rush with him on the field.
100%. But I do always question, like, how often does it work when you hold out massive amounts into the season? Like, we've seen guys hold out for a game or two, they come back, they're rusty, and they get it together. But once you start holding out more than four or five games into the season, potentially the entire season, you never really end up being the same player prior to the holdout, for whatever the reason is. So that would be a red flag in this scenario as well, that he might have missed so much football to where he'll still be good, he'll still make the team better, certainly, but if you're going to have to trade for him and then pay him, is that all going to be justified based on the performance you actually get from him?
Yeah. You know, there's also just the idea of, you know, scheme fit. You know, would it be the right scheme fit, you know, with Joe Witt and Dan Quinn's system? I mean, you know, Philly's been a base 3-4 team. Not that everybody's in base all the time. He's been, you know, an outside. He's been a pass rushing linebacker, 2-point stance pass rusher, not a 3-point stance guy. And I'm not saying that that's the position they'd put him in. They'd probably have him at linebacker anyway, as a pass rusher in a 2-point stance. But, you know, those are the things too that they know more than we know. But in terms of a talent and a go-get-the-quarterback guy, he's up there. He's not the best. He's not the elite of the elites right now, but he's been up there in terms of sack totals at times over the last few years. Where did he finish? He had his best year in 22 and the 22 regular season. Where did he finish in sacks that year? He finished second in the league behind Bosa.
He had 16. That was a crazy year.
Yeah. Tied for second with Myles Garrett behind Bosa. I mean, look, if you told me you get your choice of any pass rusher in the league, Reddick's not my first choice by a long shot. I'm going in order. Watt, I think Watt's my number one. Garrett's my number two. Bosa healthy is awfully, awfully tough to turn down. You know, interior-wise, right now you'd think about Dexter Lawrence. You'd think about Chris Jones.
Mm-hmm.
How about Max Crosby?
Yeah, I was going to say, Crosby be top. Probably, if you're just talking edge guys, the lowest he would be on that list is 7. maybe that 5-6 range, assuming that Bosa is healthy. And then you kind of like, I don't know how I'd feel. Micah Parsons coming to this defense particularly would excite me, just because we know he's had success with these two guys that are leading the defense, and Quinn and Joe Witt Jr. But I would say at the very lowest, Max Crosby's like 7 on that list, which is pretty good.
You know who I was impressed with, and I made a note of this, and you mentioned this. I think you were the one that mentioned this to me. You know who played really well, I thought, for Baltimore was Kyle Van Noy.
Kyle Van Noy, yeah. They put him in a really good spot.
He's in a really good spot. Who's leading the league in sacks right now? Is it Dexter Lawrence?
It's how many is Lawrence sacks? Kyle Van Noy had 6 coming into this week.
Aiden Hutchinson out for the year leads the league in sacks right now with 7.5. Obviously, that won't be the case. Lawrence is second. He's tied with Will McDonald. I had no idea that Will McDonald, second year. You know, this was the guy they picked, the Jets picked out of Iowa State in the 23 draft, which was a bit of a surprise pick, remember? By the way, that was the pick right in that draft before Dotson. Before Forbes. Where was Forbes picked? 16?
He was 17? 16. He was 16, and then,
McDonald that went right before Forbes.
And Gonzalez was right after. What a sandwich
Gonzalez
that
was
is.
Right after.
Yeah. I'm also bummed about the Aiden Hutchinson thing, because I'm pretty sure one of my preseason bold predictions was that guy was going to have like 14 sacks.
Oh, he's so good. When's the last time a true D tackle led the league in sacks?
Aaron Donald might have done it once.
I was going to say, it's got to be Donald.
Yeah, he might have done it once. Because remember, he went on that stretch where I was like, they might want to just name the Defensive Player of the Year award after him. He won it like 3 years in a row.
I got this from Steve, and it's kind of deep, and I'm going to read it to everybody. Kevin, I might be deranged, but hear me out. My wife left me 2 months ago. I lost my job last month. I have 2 kids in college that I'm paying for, and it's expensive out-of-state tuition. And yet, I've never felt better. Why, you ask? We have a real GM, an excellent coach, and a generational quarterback. I feel kind of guilty feeling this way, but it's true. Good morning, everybody. You know, there was a time, and maybe it's back, when the football team, as in the Redskins, they were a wonderful escape. They were a great diversion. And then for the last 25 or so years, they were actually the cause for trying to escape. But it's nice again. It is. I mean, amazing where we are just 6 games into the 2024 season. I was watching early this morning the Greenberg Show, Get Up on ESPN, and Dominique Foxworth, who, by the way, lives here. He's from here, was on essentially saying something to the effect of, you know, Washington's going to be a Super Bowl contender for years to come. They have the guy. It's so obvious. By the way, Steve, finding, happiness or positivity, I guess you would say, in the midst of chaos, that's strong backbone, in my opinion. So good for you for finding that. Good luck, too, in getting your life together in the other areas of your life, which are higher priority. I understand that. Denton, guess what? Guess who the favorite in the NFC East is right now?
Oh, I know that answer. It's right here, baby.
So I did kind of a blended average of all of the different shops out there that have put up updated NFC East odds. Not everybody's updated their odds, but most of the places have. Here is the blended average. Washington's plus 120, the favorite. Philly's plus 140. Dallas is plus 400. And the Giants are basically, you know, long shot, like 50-1, plus 5,000. Washington is the favorite to win the NFC East. Now, I have no idea, honestly, when the last time Washington was the favorite to win the NFC East this early in the season. I would guess that it was probably 2016. You know, they had won the division in 2015. They seemed to be, for most people, a team that was ascending. But remember, in 2016, they lost their first two games. So maybe before the season, they were a favorite or a slight favorite to win the division. I don't remember. But if it wasn't 2016, I doubt it was 2013 with Griffin coming off the injury. And, you know, 2005, 2007, I don't think they went into those following years. And at any point early in the season, they were a favorite. So this may be uncharted territory in terms of the last couple of decades. I would bet any amount of money that in 2000, they were the favorite before the season started to win the division. They were one of the top two or three favorites to win the Super Bowl in 2000. I mean, that's the last season that there was any legitimate high expectations for the team before the season began. But they are the favorite right now. Look, why are they the favorite right now? Well, it's a combination of two things. Number one, they've played well. And this past weekend, when they overtook Philadelphia as the favorite, they lost Philly 1, but they lost, in terms of the odds makers, in a much more impressive way than Philadelphia won their game over Cleveland. And Dallas getting absolutely ambushed by Detroit really dropped their odds, because they were kind of last week tied with Washington behind Philadelphia. You know, Dallas, the combination of getting blasted by the Lions, and then also with what they have coming up schedule-wise, you know, I think after the bye week, it's the 49ers on Sunday Night Football. It is the Falcons on the road. Both of those games are on the road. Then they have like the Eagles, Houston, Washington. I think the odds makers essentially have bailed on Dallas, and they view this as a two-horse race between Washington and Philly. But Washington's the favorite because of, you know, the landscape in the division. Dallas essentially now looking like anything but a playoff team, or certainly a division contender. Philly not looking super impressive and seemingly having a ton of turmoil, you know, in the organization with that buffoon Sirianni coaching the team. And Washington right now clearly has the best quarterback in the division. That's not even debatable, right? At this point, like, the best quarterback in the NFC East is Jaden Daniels. That's not insane to say, is it, Denton? I don't think it is.
No, he's the best quarterback in the NFC, period, right now.
I think that's probably true. Yeah, that's true. So when you have the best quarterback and you have the best offense in the division, you know, they're not saying that Washington isn't, you know, without limitations, because they are. They're not one of the favorites to win the NFC overall. I'll give you those odds here in a moment. But they are definitely viewed by the odds makers as a solid favorite. Not a solid favorite, a slight favorite right now. But that could grow. You know, that could grow with an impressive win over the Panthers. And the Eagles, look, have a tough game against the Giants this week on the road. I may die on this vine, but I don't think the Giants stink. I'm 100% convinced they don't stink on defense. And so the Eagles could lose that game. They're only a 3-point favorite over the Giants on the road. We'll see if Malik Nabers is back for that game. That would be huge for the Giants to have him back for that game. But pretty wild, man. I mean, first time in a long, long time. Now, the updated NFC championship odds. Hold on for a second. I had those a moment ago. I'll find them. I had them up in front of me a minute ago. A lot of those have not been updated, while the divisions have for some reason. But Washington was still pretty much across the board the fifth pick in the NFC. The Vikings, the Lions, the Packers, and the 49ers were all ahead of Washington in terms of odds to win the NFC. And then you also had, Atlanta and Tampa were right there, pretty close with Washington as well, to win the NFC championship. So they are viewed as the NFC East favorite, slight favorite right now. But overall, the NFC, look, the NFC landscape is different than I think we thought it would be, or most people thought it would be before the season started. The NFC North right now has Minnesota at 5-0, Detroit at 4-1, Green Bay at 4-2, and the Bears at 4-2. The NFC South has two decent teams at the top in Atlanta and Tampa, both of whom are 4-2. The NFC West is tied at the top with two 500 teams, but the 49ers, healthy, are viewed still as the favorite or right there with Detroit. You know, there is some separation, by the way, between the 49ers and Detroit, and then I think it was the Vikings who had the third best odds in the NFC. I'll find those NFC. Maybe you can find them real quickly. I had it open a moment ago. I want to see what the numbers are. We'll find it. Pretty wild. There you go.
I got more wild for you if you want wild.
What's wild?
Or do you want to finish your NFC conversation before I take us in a different direction?
No, here it is. 49ers, Lions, Vikings. The Eagles are still ahead of Washington. The Packers, Falcons are ahead of Washington in terms of NFC championship odds. You know, that's crazy. The Eagles have better NFC championship odds than Washington has currently, even though Washington's the favorite to win the division.
Draw play, Dorsett, and look out. Uh-oh, this could be bye-bye. He has great speed down the sideline. Tony Dorsett.
And look who caught him.
And Tony Dorsett goes down. Only one man on the field could catch him. Darryl Green, the world-class sprinter from Texas A&I.
He did make up some ground, too, Frank.
That was the night Darryl Green was introduced to the Washington fan base and the rest of the NFL. The season opener, 1983 Monday Night Football, Skins and Cowboys at RFK Stadium. And nobody back then could catch Tony Dorsett, but Darryl Green ran him down in what was a thrilling but a memorable loss. Washington blew a 20-point lead and lost to the Cowboys that night, 31-30. We're playing some of Darryl Green's signature moments. His number 28 retired Sunday during the Washington-Carolina game. I was wrong. Ben's going to join us earlier, I guess, on Fridays because of the Quinn get-together with the media. So we're going to get Ben on right now so he doesn't get scolded, lectured by the head coach for doing live radio hits during his press conference. So, what do you think, Sunday?
Kevin, always a pleasure, even if you forgot about me. Sunday, what's interesting is, again, I think we're all recalibrating our mind as to what's happening here, right, with this whole situation. And, you know, we've all been surprised, obviously, with this 4-2 record. It was 4-1. The thing about it is, and look, they've lost to the two teams that are the two on the record, on their schedule so far, that are like looking like playoff teams, Tampa and Baltimore, and the other ones are not that way. But they've also just taken care of business. And, the Cleveland game being the prime example, the Browns are a mess, and Washington allowed them to continue to be a mess by not, you know. And I think that, to me, is incredibly laudable and probably needs to get more attention. I before the season started, you know, my entire outlook for them was, is Jaden Daniels look like the guy, and are they competitive week in and week out? If they do those things, to me, this will be a winning season, let alone whatever the record is. So my point is, based on what we have seen, I think they're going to go out and handle business against the Panthers. Obviously, Carolina is not that good. Andy Dalton's a fine, competent quarterback, but he's not a game changer. They're giving up, as bad as Washington's run defense has been, Carolina's has been worse. They're allowing the most points in the league. They don't have a ton of game breakers on offense, though. Deontay Johnson, a receiver, and Chuba Hubbard, a running back, are pretty good. Their offensive line inside is not bad. But this is a game, based on what we've seen from Washington, that they should, you know, win. And because they're playing pretty, aggressive, competent, there's a lot of enthusiasm. So, you know, I think the game itself is not particularly exciting, you know, especially sandwiched in between a Lamar Jackson game and a Caleb Williams game. But, you know, if they keep this going, I think this will be a good sign for where they're at. Coming off a win, they were able to just take care of business in, you know, pretty matter-of-fact fashion.
Yeah, this is, I mean, we said it kind of before the Cleveland game, and we haven't said it much around here at all over the last many, many years, but this is a game they should win. You know, there aren't many in the NFL with teams that aren't either elite or good enough, but this is a game they should win. I think that's always concerning, especially when you are flawed, because Washington is flawed defensively, Ben. They are not a good defensive football team, and teams can get healthy on them and their defense. So I'm just curious as to where you are on that right now, and I know that we'll have more time to talk about this in the coming weeks, but it's been a conversation, you know, on this show the last couple of days. What can they do to become a better defense to take advantage of what has been an elite offense in quarterback play?
Well, I mean, you know, like Joe Witt Jr., who I've enjoyed listening to so far this season, you know, he puts the onus on himself, you know, I've got to do a better job of getting the message through to players. But he's also been specific in certain ways. Like yesterday he talked about how the Baltimore game, from his perspective, came down to four plays in which there was communication issues. And he
broke
it down.
What were the four plays? Do you know? I heard him say that. What were the four plays? Does anybody know?
No, I mean, he didn't say. And, you know, I mean, you obviously can look at some of the bigger ones they have, you know, whether it was the Lamar Jackson run or the Zay Flowers screen or things like that. But in the secondary, you know, he said, look, communication, you know, is about sending the message, receiving the message, and essentially acknowledging the message, comprehending it. And he talked about how in a couple instances the message was sent appropriately and somebody just didn't, you know, process what it was that they were to do. In other cases, the wrong message was sent and so on. And communication sounds like something that should be easily fixable, right? Just repetition and just an understanding. But, you know, when we say that a team needs more talent, sometimes the talent isn't just about running a 4-4-40 or making a break on an out pass. Sometimes it is just the mental side as well. And I don't really know what they can do in the secondary, to be really honest. I just think their talent level isn't good enough. And unless guys like, you know, unless certain players just have significant breakthroughs during the season, which is not impossible, we do see that, it's hard to see where this goes. Now, that's not even factoring in. They just lost Jonathan Allen. And, you know, that's at a minimum, it's taking away a viable starter, let alone the maximum aspect of a guy who's been to a Pro Bowl a couple times, taking him off the field. We'll see if Dorrance Armstrong's available this week or not. He doesn't practice yet, and I know that rib injury was definitely painful for him. So we'll see about that. But ultimately, like, you know, even if Armstrong is out there and so on, I really don't know what much they can do, particularly on the back end. You know, again, the back end's not necessarily about the run game, which has been a huge issue, but I honestly, to me, the secondary is the real concern, and I think this is where they may ultimately land a tier or so below the main contenders in the conference, because, like I said, I don't really see how they're fixing this unless Emmanuel Forbes plays and has a big turnaround, you know, that commensurate to being picked in the first round a year ago.
Well, do you think they'll do anything about it trade-wise before the deadline?
I doubt it. I mean, if we're talking about a trade in which it's going to be somebody so significant that the world will all be like, wow, I can't believe they got that guy, but that guy's going to cost you a day two pick, I doubt it. If we're just talking about taking a total flyer on somebody's veteran that maybe, you know, just be a better version of what they have now that you know, you trade a sixth-round pick for that player and a seventh or something, sure, I think that something like that on the margin, I think anybody, any team could make that. But I'd be surprised to see them make something that would all catch our attention, like, wow, I can't believe they just got that guy. I don't feel that happening.
Why?
For the same reason we've talked about all along. I just don't at the moment think they're deviating from their plan of the long-term thinking that Adam Peters is not going to trade away these picks for likely a short-term fix. They've got Carolina this week. They've got the Bears next week. And then they have the Giants. Those are three winnable games. If they win them all and they're 7-2, well, then maybe they have to have a different conversation in the room simply just based on the opportunity being presented. But I still don't know if that's, you know, where if the organization does anything. Again, the two teams that they have played this year that we would say right now are like playoff teams, Tampa and Baltimore, you know, Tampa kind of beat them up pretty good in the opener. And then last week, they were competitive against Baltimore for sure, but it also felt like the Ravens could just call their number as needed on when they had the ball. And I just don't see it happening right now. But, you know, go 3-0 in the next three games and maybe you have to change your mind.
Yeah, I think that's fair in terms of the timing of a decision. But I also think a move that could be made doesn't have to be a short-term move. You know, there are other options in addition to short-term moves.
If you can get the Montez Sweat, equivalent, like a 24, 25-year-old in the prime of their career that you in the following offseason would be willing to sign to a four-year, you know, $100 million deal, sure, those guys don't become available. But the reason he was available last year was because of the weird circumstance here of the ownership sale. They had already paid Allen and Payne. It was hard to see how you're paying the third guy. That's the thing. We could, sure, anything is possible if the circumstances are there, but the odds of the circumstances being like that are pretty slim. Those guys don't get traded, typically, let alone at the deadline.
Who's out this weekend? Who do we have to be concerned about Sunday?
I think Armstrong's the one to watch. Again, he hasn't practiced this week. I don't think the rib injury is like, you know, any long-term issue, but he was, you know, definitely in some legit pain. And we'll have to see. He was with the team stretching yesterday, which arguably is a positive sign. But then he went to the side field when practice started, and they listed him as a did not practice. So if he doesn't go today, you know, it seems unlikely he plays on Sunday based on general how these things work. But, if he's not able to go, you know, not only has he been, you know, one of their better pass rushers, but, you know, you take him off the field with John Allen the same week. Javonte Jean-Baptiste had been, you know, high up in the rotation. Now he's also on IR. So that would be a big blow. They don't have a ton of depth that, on the defensive end, you'd have Cleveland Farrell and Dante Fowler presumably getting most of the reps. And then you're looking at, what, F.A. Obata, who was back last week off IR, and I guess the never-ending discussion of whether Jamin Davis is going to have a role or not. So the depth thins out pretty quick if he's not able to go.
Ben Standig joining us at Ben Standig on X on Twitter. Read him on The Athletic. He's got a podcast, Last Man Standig. Emmanuel Forbes, you've already mentioned him. What do you see as his role Sunday?
I mean, based on what we've seen and what they have said, I see no role for him on Sunday. I'd be pleasantly surprised. You know, the other day, I think it was talked on Monday, but we had Dan Quinn, and I asked him first. He's been playing Mikey Sanderson on the outside. Is the plan, though, for him to still be a long-term slot corner? And he said, yeah. Okay. So one way to sort of deal with that now is bring Forbes in, let him play on the outside, and put Sanderson inside. I mean, unless you're telling me that the Sanderson with Noah Igbinoghi combo is just that much better than whatever Forbes could or couldn't do, then it seems like I would try that, but they're not at the moment, you know, looking to do it. They said last week he was inactive because they wanted to have an extra defensive lineman up you know, to battle the Ravens running game. And okay, maybe I get that to an extent, but it doesn't apply that, like, you could still start him. He can't play special teams. That's kind of the rub, or he's not much going to be much of a help there. So, but if you start him, you don't have the special teams is a lesser of an issue. You can, you know, make another player inactive, whether Michael Davis or somebody. So, you know, he may be active this week, but they're going to have to do a 180 on how they're viewing him right now, it appears, for me to think he's going to play.
And Brian Robinson Jr. is a go, right? Sunday?
Barring a setback, he looks like he's going to play, yes.
All right. Thanks for doing this. Appreciate it. Talk to you later.
Yeah, man. See ya.
Ben Standing, everybody.
Darryl Green goes back deep for Washington. Barnhart punting against the wind. Out of his own end zone. Good kick. Chases Green back to his own 48-yard line, but he's got some room. Darryl Green. Good goal. Could be all over. It is all over.
Darryl Green had a lot of memorable moments during his incredible 20-year career in Washington, but that punt return in Chicago back in January of 1988 is number one. A great corner, the greatest corner in the history of the franchise. I think you could argue the greatest defensive player in the history of the franchise. His number one most memorable play was that punt return in Chicago. Good morning, Football Friday, week 7 of the NFL season already. Washington and Carolina Sunday in Landover, where Darryl Green's number 28 will be retired. A deserving honor, of course. I do think that Darryl Green is the greatest defensive player in franchise history. He's certainly the greatest cornerback in franchise history. 20 incredible seasons, all in Washington, 7 Pro Bowls, 4 first-team All-Pro honors during his career. During his first 10 years, the team was excellent. He played on 3 NFC title teams, 2 Super Bowl winning teams. Darryl Green played in 18 career playoff games. He missed one in 92 in Minnesota, but that was it. His teams played in 19 playoff games. He played in 18. Yeah, that's when the franchise was rather special. The fastest man in the NFL, probably for all 20 of his years. I mean, he was 42 when he finally hung it up. He was probably still in that, you know, year, if not the fastest guy in the NFL, one of the 2 or 3 fastest in the NFL. Just an incredible player and clearly one of the franchise's all-time best and fan favorites as well. The Mount Rushmore of players in franchise history includes Darryl Green. I think the other three would be Sammy Baugh, Sonny Jurgensen, and Riggo. I think that's the Mount Rushmore franchise-wise of players, you know, not counting coaches. Sammy Baugh, Sonny, Riggo, and Darryl Green. That punt return in Chicago, though, wow, what a memory for those of us that remember it. Denton does not. He's here with me. He was not even born yet. That game was played in absolute frigid weather. That was the 87 regular season. They played 15 regular season games because of, remember, the strike and the replacement players. They went to Chicago. They were an underdog in that game at Soldier Field. They were about a 4.5, 5-point underdog against the Bears. They had already beaten the Bears the previous year in the postseason. They had had a history playing Chicago in the postseason. They had lost a game at RFK in the 84 season, won at Soldier Field 27-13 after the 86 season. And then in 87, they went to Chicago in 4-degree weather. Yeah, the kickoff game time temperature was 4 degrees. The wind chill made it minus 20. And Washington won the game 21-17. It was Darryl Green's punt return that gave them the lead that they would not relinquish. The punt return actually came in the third quarter. I know a lot of people, in remembering that game, say, remember Darryl Green's punt return at the end of the game in Chicago? It actually came in the third quarter. It was 14-14. He returned that punt. Everybody remembers him grabbing his rib because on a cutback, he hurt himself. Ended up playing the next week because he made a huge play in that game too, on Darren Nelson at the end of the NFC Championship game. But congrats to Darryl Green, his jersey getting retired here on Alumni Weekend. They used to call this, remember when they called it Homecoming Weekend? In fact, the first year of this Homecoming / Alumni Weekend was 2012, and guess who they played? They played the Carolina Panthers, and D'Angelo Williams and company came in here and won the game. And D'Angelo Williams, after the game, said, I saw on the program it said homecoming game. And he said, I just couldn't believe in the NFL they had a homecoming game. They thought they were going to treat us like we were a homecoming opponent. And he just said, I was pissed. And the Panthers won the game. They stopped calling it homecoming. And they now, for many years, have referred to it as Alumni Weekend. Not a great move by Bruce that particular year to dub the game a homecoming game. But Darryl Green will be front and center of Alumni Weekend. They're expecting over 150 former players back for this game. That's a lot, considering what they've been unable to draw back at times over the years. Different day. That is for sure. I'll play for you throughout the morning some of the signature plays of Darryl Green's career, kind of coming back into segments, because Darryl Green had several signature moments. You just heard number one. I don't think anybody would debate that that's number one. I think you could argue that it's the second most famous or most memorable play in franchise history. Of course, Riggo's 4th-and-1 in Super Bowl 17 is number one. That's a clear number one, no debate. Number two, I think I'd probably go Dexter, Darryl Grant, NFC Championship game, Dexter tipping Gary Hogaboom's pass, Darryl Grant picking it off and returning it for the clinching touchdown, which sent Washington to Super Bowl 17. But I think number three for me would be Darryl Green's punt return at Soldier Field in Chicago. That was a wow play. Man, those teams under Joe Gibbs, they won a ton of road playoff games as underdogs. Again, some of Darryl's other signature plays we will come back into segments with throughout the morning. By the way, I was thinking about this and talking to Tommy on my podcast yesterday about it. I actually don't think it's that hard, but the next year, if they're continuing to retire jerseys, and I think that there are three more that have to be retired, and put them in any order you want, but Charlie Taylor's 42, John Riggins 44, and Art Monk's 81 are the three jerseys that have to be retired. After that, everything is debatable, in my opinion. But as somebody who's followed this organization for a long, long time, those are three givens in terms of jerseys and numbers retired. In terms of the order, I think Riggo should be next year. I think, in terms of stature, I think his should go next. And then, you'd go Charlie Taylor, who passed away a few years ago and was one of the greatest receivers in NFL history. Charlie Taylor was the all-time receptions leader when he retired from the game. And then probably Art after that. But I think Riggo should be next. That would be my preference. And that should happen in 2025. But congrats to Darryl Green. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the day. It is certainly deserved, a Mount Rushmore Washington Redskin, Washington franchise football player of all time.